Yeah, if we're going to talk for more than an hour.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
You're surprised.
No. We can't. I can't.
Well, let's see. She wants
too much to do.
We might as well just start over.
Yeah.
No, let me see.
No, I know what I was starting to say two or three times was, I mean, the reasons I got into folklore and when I got into folklore were, well, it's when I was in college. I was an English major, which I think a lot of people start out like that. I'm just interested in the arts. In my case, I guess I was just interested in writing narratives. But somewhere along the line, I was also very interested in music and American music, primarily old-time fiddle and banjo music, blues. But somewhere along the line, I started realizing that while the literature was nice, I enjoyed reading, that what I was interested in had a lot more to do with what people do in their everyday life and just how ordinary, regular old people entertain themselves on a day-in and day-out basis, whether it's playing music or whether it's talking about their lives or telling jokes or really anything like that. And that literature, or the classes anyway, didn't have a lot to do with that. And that they were primarily biased towards a white West European, and the view of the world and view of what was good art and what was bad art. And somewhere along the line, a teacher mentioned that there was this thing called folklore, and maybe that was what I was interested in. And it sounded good to me, so I started looking into it and decided that, yes, indeed, this was what I was interested in. It was a great revelation. I mean, to read some of the first things that I read by folklorists, that there were other people that thought the way I did or were had already found out things that I was just starting to figure out. It was very enjoyable. But I think that was the main reason why I got into folklore, was that I was interested in other cultures and interested in just what normal human beings did. So
John was saying that turns out maybe 90% of what people do is folklore. What isn't folklore?
Well, I don't know. For every folklorist, you'll find a different answer. The standard definition, I guess, of folklore through the ages, or since there's been a discipline, is something along the lines of folklore encompasses the tradition, the customs, and verbal arts that are passed down from generation to generation. This is sort of the collective wisdom of a culture that accumulates over time. And the standard notion of folklore by a lot of people is that it's old wives' tales, that it's this quaint stuff that's told by grandmothers and grandfathers, and it does include some of that, but it's also very vital, and it is ongoing. It's something that never dies out. People, as long as people have the creative capacity and draw upon their own wisdom, whether it's a sense of values or whether it's how to make a house or how to make a basket or how to play music, there will always be folklore. As long as people have that capacity to entertain themselves and to create art, there will always be folklore. So, I mean, it's you find it in children, you find it in any walk of life. I mean, that's the other standard notion is, well, one, that folklore is false and that folklore is found only among lower classes, which is totally untrue. Folklorists have, I think, in the past tended to focus only on those people. And primarily rural people, just because they're more isolated from sort of changes in technology and urbanization. So they tend to hold on to a lot of things, perhaps a lot longer. Yeah, than, say, somebody in suburbia. But you find that, you find it everywhere. You'll find it in suburbia.
Sure. Does it get to be an argument kind of like antiques and people bemoan the fact that now they're calling stuff made in the 40s antiques? And you find people who bemoan the fact that even if it's in suburbia and they've only been doing it for 10 years, it's still folklore.
Mm-hmm.
How can it be folklore?
Mm-hmm. No, I know. I know. No, that's what that whole New Yorker cartoon sounds like it's all about.
She's got a chicken on her lap. You know, she's smoking a pipe. Well, why? Okay, if it's never going to die, I mean, I assume you feel that. How could it die? It's so interwoven with this life, whether they know it or not. What's the purpose of collecting it and presenting it to other people?
Oh, I mean, there are a lot of reasons to collect folklore. One is just to preserve it. I mean, on the one hand, folklore in general or folklore per se will never die out, although some forms of folklore will die out. I mean, people are creative. They can adapt. They're resilient. Things like fairy tales, like Cinderella and Jack and the Beanstalk. Stories like that aren't told really anymore, except if they're read out of a book. But they're not actively told and passed on, at least in this country, like they were, say, maybe 100 years ago. For whatever reason, the function that they had or the purpose that they served is no longer there. Certain types of, say, barn construction or certain types of building, or things like baskets, say, they were important at one time. They served a function. Maybe they don't anymore. People use different materials now that are cheaper, that are perhaps more functional. You can get plastic containers. You don't need to go out and cut down an oak tree and peel the bark and do all of that. It does take a long time. So in that sense, some parts of folklore do die out, and before they die out, they should be recorded somewhere, because unfortunately, historians, like everybody else, tend to, their sense of history and the sense of history that we all grow up with, at least in America, I think, is that it's dates and facts and it's great events done by great men. And those things are true. But ultimately, history is a lot more than that, and it has to do, again, with how just the tenor of a time period, of an era, and what goes into that is what people do every day. Their attitudes, the way they look at life, just maybe what somebody would do in the course of a day. What kinds of activities would they do? What somebody would do in 1850 or 1750 is incredibly different than what they would do in 1982. That history is... I mean, it's a combination of all kinds of people. I don't know, working together, thinking, making decisions, laughing, joking, living and dying, yeah. And that's not recorded. And I think a lot of people, I mean, the other thing is, let's face it, the great events and the great people that make all the great decisions really, I don't think anyway, affect people's lives in a really fundamental way. I mean, a president dying or it may affect your life and you may stop and think about it, but ultimately it's just not going to have the kind of impact on how you see the world, as your very immediate surroundings are much more important. And that stuff isn't in history books, and it should be. And that should be corrected, because I think part of what a result of that is that people, they don't think they're that important. They don't think that they're sort of part of life and part of a culture, and that they do have contributions to make. And that what they do is important. I know one of the most satisfying things of being a folklorist, and particularly working in a state government or a public sector type of position, is when you go out and talk with people and really sit down and find out, what did you do and what was your life like and what kinds of skills do you have? You not only tell them that they're important, and quite often sometimes you're the first person that's paying attention to somebody in a long time. People take these things for granted. They don't think it's important or that it's special. But the other thing is when you can, say, give them back something, give them something concrete, like a tape, or in the case of the Florida Folklife Program, I know one experience I had, we made a record, and I helped distribute the records once they were made to the people who appeared on the record of traditional blues Afro-American music. And it was the most, it was just an exciting thing. The family was just tickled to death, and particularly because the father of the family had just died not too many months before. And this is really one of the only records they had. What? Neither of them are working?
Yeah, one more.
The other one is this. Which one is it? That one?
Yeah. All right, I've got it on the other channel.
Okay.
All right, now give me some. The wind was right.
Oh, okay.
Well, we're all right.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was. Yeah, you had told me about that before.
Yeah.
Right. And John was saying some of that same thing, that these kids had no idea that what they were just passing around when they were still standing.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's true. I mean, it does sound like a cliche, but I mean, as they say, there's usually some truth to cliches, and it does help. Folklore does help to anchor somebody. It does sort of give them some sort of base to go from. Not that all folklore, though, is terrific and wonderful saying just blindly that tradition is wonderful and all tradition should be preserved. Well, not all of folklore is folklore contains a lot of racism and a lot of sexism and a lot of sort of anti-cultural pluralism or whatever, I mean, for lack of a better word. So it's not all neat and nice and pretty, because people aren't like that. I mean, they are and they aren't. People have smooth edges and they have rough edges, and folklore does too.
What kind of training do you get academically to discriminate? How do you make decisions about what to collect, what to present, how to deal with sensitive issues, and how do you turn the thing you've been running into this year? Let's talk a little bit about that. How do you tell people, well, that is not folk art, that's not a very pretty side of it either.
No.
How do you discriminate that, and what do you do about it? Of course, in a public situation, it's a lot harder. I mean, obviously, you're opening yourself up. It's jack like egos. But what kind of training do you get? Maybe that's the question. How do you, what criteria do you use to discriminate?
Well, and I mean, in your schooling, you get your academic training of just various courses, various genres. Learn the background about it, where things come from, how they're related. Of course, a folklorist, like anybody, you can't be fully aware and fully knowledgeable of everything in the world. Because folklore, like cultures, it changes. It's quite often very vernacular and sometimes doesn't translate from culture to culture. And you have to learn about that. So you usually will specialize in a few cultural areas. Then you just have to go out, I mean, with that background. You learning how to interview, what kinds of questions to ask. You can go out in an interview and say somebody, because, well, the bane of every folklorist is when you go out into a community, people will say, I know exactly what you're talking about. I know so-and-so, and you really have got to go talk with them. And so you go, and sometimes it pans out, and it turns out to be a good lead. And sometimes it doesn't. Because the person is trying to be helpful, but they really don't know what you're looking for. So you may go out, and you waste some time talking with this person. I mean, I learned this the hard way, just from doing that, taking everybody at face value. But you go out there, and you'll find out, oh, they just learned this 2 years ago out of a book or whatever. And how you just ask certain questions. There are certain questions. Yeah. For instance, like, how long have you been practicing this tradition? Where did you learn it? How did you learn it? Who did you learn it from? Actually, those are sort of the big ones. I mean, I suppose it's probably a lot like being a reporter, really. Although, accuracy in that kind of textbook sense is not necessarily the point or the thing of what we're after. But it's just trying to get some verification. If somebody says to, I ask someone, how did you learn this? And they say, well, I read it out of a book. that would make a note in my mind, and I would probably question a little bit further, but I would probably say, okay, well, then this is not folklore. Because the thing about folklore, if it's in writing, that doesn't always mean, well, this is not folklore, but it just usually does mean that. Folklore is very malleable, folk traditions are, and they usually are passed on orally, just one person talking to another person, or one person showing another person how to do something, and having that person learn it by imitation or something like that. It usually isn't written down. And the other thing that is important is that folklore varies. Quite often, once something gets into a book, it will become sort of frozen or dead. And that's why I say something when Cinderella, the story Cinderella, is not really an active folk tradition anymore, is because the people that are reading it out of a book will not take that story and then maybe change it a little bit or add a little bit, maybe take away a little bit. They'll just go to that book every time, get it out, and read it word for word, and then put it right back on the shelf and really not think about it at all. Where a story that is sort of in someone's active repertoire, like everybody tells stories about my most embarrassing moment. Everybody has that. Or my first date. They're just these certain types of stories. Everybody's got them. Everybody tells them. And, whether it's exaggerating or lying or whatever, people embellish over the years. They refine their own stories that they tell to audiences. Everyone loves to entertain people. So you'll be in one group of friends and tell a story. You'll observe, and maybe not consciously, but you'll know what gets a laugh and what doesn't get a laugh. And you'll work on that. And then the next time you tell it, maybe 6 months later, you might embellish that one little segment maybe just a little bit more, or take something out, or forget something. But everybody does it. And that's folklore. That's vital. It's living. It's a part of people's lives.
Folklore doesn't exclude showbiz.
No. It doesn't exclude show business.
If you could be self-consciously doing what you're doing, I guess you would have to be the greatest basket maker in three counties.
Well, that's the other thing. A lot of times I think people think of folklore in the same sense that they've tended to associate it with poor people, is that it's unconscious, that people aren't aware of their artistry, and that's not necessarily true either. People say proverbs all the time in their conversation. That's one thing. A stitch in time saves nine. That doesn't require a whole lot of thought, and it's just in the air. Everybody knows those things. But things like personal experience stories that everybody tells, it requires a certain amount of artistry. And everybody knows, I think most people know a good storyteller among their friends, and they may even consider themselves a good storyteller, but they know what they like. Everybody knows probably a good joke teller. And a person is probably very aware that they're good at that they excel at that. That's art, and they know it. Although I guess if you called them an artist, they would kind of...
Some of them would, some of them.
Yeah. But the same with crafts. If you talk with most quilters, if they're really good, they usually know they are. I mean, they're going around either talking with other... So a quilter would talk with other women, perhaps, find out, look at other quilts, ask them what they do. And there's a particular aesthetic that perhaps they're all striving for. A woman will make aesthetic judgments and just say, this quilt is good and this quilt is not. And depending on just how talkative or articulate they are, if you ask them, why is this a good quilt or why isn't it a good quilt, they can give you a perfectly reasonable explanation. They know what goes into that.
John was telling me he was in Lake City the other day, and so mm-hmm. I said, what do you do for a living? And he said, I'm a folklorist.
Thank you.
Oh, you don't have to work. So I had an idea. What he said, maybe folklore has a bad image, a bad press. People don't really understand what folklore is and what folklorists do and what's the meaning of it.
My own family does. I think that's true, although I think, I don't think folklore is unusual with that kind of, having that kind of image problem. I think most arts, humanities kind of thing has the same problem now, that there's a lot of bias against the arts, but there always has been. That it's not essential to living, like eating and having a roof over your head is essential, and that the people who provide those services or participate in that are doing something really important, which they are. But I just think without art of any kind, whether it's traditional art or so-called fine art, I think people would die. I just think it's the most fundamental expression of being human that there is.
Well, it's interesting that people are doing it and don't know it, and there have to be professionals to put their finger on it to tell people this, what you're doing here is really something. They don't get it. It's too normal in their lives, and to realize that it has something to
do. It is. I mean, sometimes I've talked with some people that I've interviewed that in the course of the conversation you explain, well, this is what I'm doing and this is why I'm interviewing you, and what you do is very special and this knowledge that you possess is very special, and there's no one else like you who knows this. And some people will say, I never thought of it like that, and that's really great, and I never thought this was important. And then some other people will just say, why are you doing this? This is dumb. And you don't need to come out and interview me about this. It's information. Other people know it. And if it gets forgotten, it gets forgotten. It's no great loss to anybody. And sometimes, I mean, you can sort of see both sides of the story sometimes. I don't know how you resolve the dilemma of having somebody come to someone else. I mean, train to tell other people that what they do is important and that it should be preserved and documented for the future. I don't know. I really don't have an answer to that.
Have you, I think one of the questions on this page is, how have you changed, how has it affected you being a folklorist? What perceptions have been
I don't know if I could, certainly couldn't answer that in 25 words or less. I would think, I mean, on several levels, just on personal level, doing field work or interviewing someone, you can get involved in a lot of very funny and strange circumstances. You have to learn how to improvise, and you have to learn how to think on your feet. And be
Yeah, tell some great stories. Tell some wonderful experiences at where did you have some great ones? You had some good ones in Pensacola. Or probably did you even go on that Haitian trip, did you?
No, I didn't, but that sounded good. That definitely sounded good. No, but a folklorist, and again, I suppose there'd be a lot of similarities, I would assume anyway, with, say, journalists or who have to deal with people from every walk of life, from very rich to very poor, and you record in the most, sometimes the most crazy circumstances, in a country store or at a dance or, I don't know. but you've just got to be able to be flexible and to go with it. And I've been present where families start arguing and have family arguments to people making private confessions and crying, to people giving you, one woman gave me, interviewed her and her husband, and they were very poor, and she cooked dinner for me. That's the other thing, you eat a lot of meals that that sometimes you don't want to eat, but she cooked this wonderful dinner, and then afterwards, before I left, she gave me all these plates. She gave me these dishes for my hope chest, or for when I got married, everything that I would need, and some tablecloths. But the people will just, most people are just so kind and so generous, and they'll, you just have to know what to do, what to say, how to react in those situations. The other thing I've learned is, well, just how narrow my own worldview has always been, which can't be helped. I mean, you just grow up a certain way and you have a certain set of experiences and a way you see the world. And thinking that's right. And then just being exposed to all other different kinds of worldviews and points of view. People are, I don't know, they're amazing. but they are very resilient and just keep going sometimes under quite a bit of adversity. You just can't keep them down. And I've also been very impressed, or just had certain things that I understood intellectually but have seen firsthand, or that people, and this is another reason I like folklore, and probably another reason why I got interested in folklore, is that I know people always say everybody's the same and there's such a thing as the human spirit and there are certain universals, which I suppose there are, but they take different shapes and forms. Always, they're expressed in different ways according to somebody's own personal predilections or their culture, how they grew up. And that's what's so interesting, and that's where I think that creativity comes in, and that if everybody was the same, it would just be so boring. But everybody is not, and there's so many different cultures, and I can appreciate some of them and understand it, and be very supportive of some other cultures. Some things I don't understand, although hopefully I'm starting to learn enough about myself now that I can admit when I don't understand something or have trouble with something. But I don't know. I mean, those are some of the things that.
What course does a folklorist follow? I assume you'd move up the ranks and soon get into administration, not do any more field work, and then is that what generally happens? Is that what you want to do? I should think you want to stay out in the field for a while.
Not really. That. Yeah, I suppose it. Well, and again, that just depends on the folklorist and what the folklorist wants to do. There certainly is that kind of upward mobility, and at least in most government or applied folklore jobs, unfortunately, moving up the ladder ultimately means getting away from what you love to do, which is practice folklore and get out in the so-called field. And get out and talk with people and interview people. That's the most exciting part. It's the most frustrating part, too. Yes! Oh. You could either teach or you can work in government and move up the ladder. And there certainly is a art to being a good administrator, but I suppose that just depends on what somebody decides what they want to do with their life. If they're good at administration, want to do it, you certainly get paid more, and that's the crazy thing. Yeah, it is. It is true in every field. Because I mean, going out in the field, or just the whole idea of the field, is kind of crazy in itself, which is, anthropologists would have the same concept, but when you hear an anthropologist or a folklorist talk about, I'm going in the field, or I've been in the field, the field can be anywhere. It can be New York City, it can be Timbuktu, it could be at your next door neighbor's house, but I mean, what they're referring to is a state of mind of sort of total receptivity, sort of learning to be like a sponge, of just soaking up everything, seeing the potential in everything, and being completely alert. It's very draining.
Were describing it, it's almost like a meditation in a way. You're submerging your own ego in something else and not imposing your thoughts and ideas on the situation very much.
We're trying not to. I mean, that's the hard thing about doing field work, and unfortunately, I don't think it's something you learn in school. It's something they don't teach in school, and that's the human element in field work.
It's all about it.
Yeah. Because you're taught to go out and be like a scientist and gather this data. Well, you are gathering data. You're getting texts and you're getting stories and jokes or recipes or rhymes, all kinds of things. But there's also this human interaction that's going on, and all kinds of things can go on. The person might not like you. You might not like the person you're interviewing. They might not be very talkative, and you've got to get them talking. You've got to show them that you have an interest in them. You just can't sit down and say, I want this, I want that. You've got to learn things. Like if someone gets off on a tangent, getting away from the subject at hand, you can't just cut them off and say, shut up, I'm not interested. You have to learn how to steer the conversation back to where you want it. Yeah, but the other thing is that I think folklorists often go in thinking, I'm going there to get this information and get all this great data to take back, not realizing that the role they're playing and who they are is just as important. And quite often the person they're interviewing, I mean, they expect something back too. They want to know about your life. They want to know who you are and want you to stay for dinner or do whatever.
Alan Jabor said the same thing in one of his phone by phone. You're documenting them, they're documenting.
They are. They really are. And, I mean, you have this persona or this role. You're thinking of yourself as a folklorist. They're not necessarily thinking of you like that. Or I mean, they've got a totally different perception. Because ultimately, they might really not know what a folklorist is. I mean, you can try and tell them, but it means something different.
John Martin said he thought it helpful often not to say you're a folklorist, but you're just interested in learning how you make a barn and how you bring that up.
Yeah. That's one tactic. I mean, that's the other thing. There's so many different ways to do field work or to be a folklorist or whatever. I mean, there's just not one textbook way. You've got to feel out what's comfortable for you to do and what's not. I know some people have suggested, well, I say I'm an oral historian or a historian. And I think I've even used that on a couple of occasions. It can backfire on you, though. Especially a historian, because then people want to give you genealogies and you're not necessarily interested in that. You're not necessarily interested in family trees, but I usually say I'm a folklorist. And then I'm interested in a local area or interested in such and such. And I heard from Jimmy Jones or John Doe that you did this, and I'd like to hear more about it.
That's just the way John described it. He said it often is confusing to say you're a folklorist. People just don't understand it. I mean, even educated people, what I've seen when we're out together, what?
The American Forklift Society. How do you spell that? I find it's real hard too when you're talking. Oh no, you don't have to give me a microphone. You can do this later.
Get spouting.
Golden words. Yeah, there's one microphone here that's been acting up. I don't know what it is. Why? Yeah. Do you think maybe it needs a new battery?
It could be. You don't have one with you. No.
This is a textbook example of bad field work.
Yeah, no extra batteries. Oh, no. What to do in the field when you have everything but the batteries.
Mm-hmm.
And you're 50 miles from nowhere. Mm-hmm. Now, I think one of the hardest parts about being a folklorist, like you were saying, is that when you go in the field, people don't react to you as a folklorist. They start reacting to you as a friend because you are establishing a personal relationship with them. And the more people you establish a relationship with, the harder it is, because you gather informants, and as time goes on, you feel like you need to keep up with these people. You feel that you've really committed yourself to a relationship with them on an ongoing basis, more or less. And especially if you're charged with the duty of going out every week and finding new people and getting new relationships, it's really draining on you physically and mentally and emotionally to try and keep up with everybody and just do the courteous kinds of things that you would do as a human being. It's just gets overwhelming after a while.
Yeah.
Is there a lot of burnout?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I would say that I know for myself, and you know, it's not for the tape, but when Doug and I were going to go to the Folklife Festival up at the World's Fair on our vacation, and I was going to I wanted to see the World's Fair in some ways. Mm-hmm. But the more I thought about it, I thought, what, am I crazy or something? I mean, yeah. I don't want to see anything to do with anybody that's old rural or, you know. I mean, I just don't want to think about folklore. When I get away, I want to get away. I want to immerse myself in contemporary culture.
Right.
Right.
That's
punk.
Right. That's you know? Right. Love
anything
it.
But folklore. Because it is... I think it's like anything where you deal with people. If you're a social worker, if you're a psychologist, if you're a folklorist, they're very similar in some ways, in that you're being involved in people's lives all the time, and you do burn out. You get really, you don't want to talk to anybody new. I know in the field, some people are really good at this, being able to go out in the field for extended lengths of time, like 3 weeks at a time. I personally cannot do that without a break, because I know after 4 or 5 days of constantly meeting new people and doing what I have to do, I don't want to call anybody, and I don't want to meet anybody new. I don't want to meet anybody. So, you know, it's, I don't know, you really have to psych yourself up for it if you're going in the field. Like you say, it is like, the field is a state of mind, and it's not relaxing.
No, it's not. I know, for instance, one of the reasons working in Tennessee last summer made such a lasting impression on me was that it was just 4 months nonstop in the field. I mean, it would be like going off to Asia or Africa and just living in some little village. Mm-hmm. You just lived there, and you did it all day, all night, and it's just what you did.
You became something that you really were not.
No, and it gets very, very hard. I could never keep up something like that. This job has been a lot different in that respect. It's been a lot more reasonable in terms of pace and in terms of the field work. You just go out for like a week at a time, or, you know, there have been breaks. There have been periods where it'd get crazy and everything, but working in Tennessee was just, it was just incredible. And I know by the end of the summer, all of the field workers, we had just had it. We really were close to burning
out. Do you think
out.
That's because, though, like in the job in Tennessee, you were hired as a field worker, whereas someone else was doing the administration and the contacts with the capital and the all of that, the kind of work that, like in the program here, you go into the field, but then you have to come back and you have to deal with Tallahassee, you have to deal with administration, and also you're with a community of 12 other folks who are doing their own projects, and you can get together and just, you know.
Well, that was a lot of it, which what I was saying, I mean, it would be a lot like, say, going off to Asia or Africa and living in that village, because you live right there in the community. You have people you can talk with. I mean, your informants, because that's who you see all day, or park employees, but you never really see any other folklorists. You're there by yourself. You're isolated. And you're just getting you're being a sponge every day, and you're just taking in more and more stuff, and you're taking pictures every day. Or if you're not taking pictures, then you're setting up programs, and you're bringing these folk artists into the parks and presenting them to other people, which also requires a lot of energy and just being priming yourself to get up and be outgoing and energetic and cordial and friendly and picking people up and transporting them and taking them back. So it's just you're right there all the time. There's no break. There's no relief. So yeah, it's hard. Yeah. I mean, so we had to do a lot of the programming and publicity. We had to do all of that. But administration with Nashville, we didn't have to do any of that. So it was just all field work all the time.
When I first came here, it was a very similar situation because it was just me in the beginning. And White Springs was definitely a change from even Kentucky. And I was living in a small town in Kentucky before I came here. But it was like being in the field. I mean, I found myself really wondering when work was ending and I was starting. You become involved in the town politics, in the town, you know, relationships that are going on, because you do become part of the town. If there's only 800 people in the town, you make a big difference when you come. And at the same time, you're looking at people as a folklorist, you also have to look at them as your neighbors, because it's not like a time-limited position. It was like, here you are, this is your new home. It was really strange to, on one level, be socializing as yourself, and on the other level, sometimes you're socializing as a social scientist or an observer. And
Yeah, it's very hard. I mean, because at the same time that you have to be very flexible and adaptable to all kinds of situations, whether it is being in the field and interviewing somebody or trying to track someone down to going to a board meeting, you begin to wonder after a while whether you have a personality anymore, because you have to change so much and be almost like a chameleon. And I don't mean necessarily lie, although I suppose maybe there's an element of that involved. But just being so flexible, at some points you just begin to think you don't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. That a you with a personality and an ego and everything just isn't there. Because you're hearing so many different points of view, and part of your job is to concentrate on just that. I mean, it's not like, say, working, say, on a construction job where you would be working with a lot of different people and you'd be hearing all kinds of different things, but it's not your job to focus and zero in on that. You can let some stuff go in one ear and out the other, where being a folklorist, you're not supposed to anyway. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you reach that saturation point where you just can't hear it anymore. I know I've done a couple of interviews where I've really sort of been on automatic pilot. Just not...
Let it roll.
Yeah, I'm just not there. Mm-hmm.
Do young people get into folklore and maybe after a year or two find out, whoa, this is...
For various reasons, though. Some people get into it because intellectually they like the idea, and for some of them, I think field work becomes a stumbling block. They realize they can't get out and cut it and do that. It's hard for them to be adaptable. Maybe they're not outgoing, or they're shy or whatever. For some others, I think a lot of people get in because they have a romantic, a very romantic notion of what the folk, who the folk are, and what folklore is, and that it is a sort of old-timey, really nice rural stuff. And they get in and they start reading the books, and for one, they don't want to read the books because it just, you don't need all this theory, you don't need all this background. You just go out and get it, and the folk are there, and they just live naturally, and it's wonderful. Which is nice, but the folk aren't like that. I mean, some are nice and wonderful, and some aren't, and some live in cabins, and but a lot of them don't. And they just don't want to be bothered with that. Their romantic notion starts getting shattered, and some of them just say, forget it. This is not what I thought it was. Mm-hmm. I'm getting out.
Yeah, a lot of people, I don't think, realize how much discipline there is involved in the study and the just doing folklore. A lot of folklorists never go in the field. There are folklorists who are what I would call library
armchair
folklorists, who do, I mean, what they do is valuable in that they can go to an archive and analyze texts to death, but they themselves never come in contact with the folk. And then there are other people who are very good at going in the field and collecting, but can never analyze what they got. So I guess there's room for both. But I have noticed myself with people I've graduated from, a lot of people do study folklore, but then end up not using that as a vocation. Maybe kind of dropping out altogether from folklore for various reasons. Maybe they were taking it as a supplement to something like a teaching job, or taking it, as Betsy said, because they had a romantic idea of what it was, and when they found out that's not what it was, they went back to what they were doing before, being a earth person or whatever, and you know, growing vegetables and weaving on a loom and being what they consider to be the folk.
There's a lot of that in you.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's hard to make a living. It's hard to make a living being a musician. Just
I'm
like,
sure as a folklorist, too, there aren't that many positions.
Right. And
more people, I think, would want to be musicians than aspire that.
Yeah,
high
yeah.
Profile.
And, too, as far as musicians go, a lot of folklorists get into folklore because they actually start out with an interest in either a craft or a form of folk music. Perhaps they play the guitar and they started reading up about traditional folk singers, and they decide, hey, I'd like to know more about it. And then when they do find out more about it, either they can accept that and really be excited about what folklore really is or what the totality is, or else maybe they drop out again. I know, I myself got into it that way. I played folk music. Yeah. I was doing crafts and had no idea you could study folklore. That was never offered as something you could study. I mean, never did my high school guidance counselor say, you could be a folklorist. I mean, it wasn't even an option. It was, I mean, I'm sure she said, what is that? So it was something that combined a lot of different interests that I personally had. And luckily, when I did find out what it was, which was not what I thought it was, you know, I liked what it was. But it wasn't what I thought it was. Definitely.
Well, I know when I finally got into graduate school in folklore, because I still wasn't completely sure what it was either. And in some ways, it wasn't completely what I thought it was either. I did realize after a while that a lot of things I was interested in was popular culture. I was interested in a lot of folklore stuff, too, but, I mean, I'm still interested in a lot of popular culture that I wouldn't be able to study in a pure sort of folklore. Oh, there is.
In fact, more and more, there's an overlap. One of my favorite papers at the American Folklore Society one year was on professional wrestling and the ritual and traditional kinds of things that go on in professional wrestling. And that same paper was then given at the popular culture meetings because there is definitely a parallel there of what's going on. It's real hard to separate. Mm-hmm. Now people are studying the Supreme Court as a folk group, the justices of the Supreme Court, who have their own rituals before they go out into chambers. They do their special handshake and this and that. Mm-hmm. And that's about the most elite institution you can find. And yet, here is an elite cultural group who really, they are a folk group also. So the definitions are getting more and more difficult to separate. Mm-hmm. It's just really,
but it always seems to be on the level of just simple human day-to-day things. That's what folklore is. Mm-hmm. Nothing overblown. People don't think it's anything special. They just do that.
Although, I mean, I think you're right about that. Although folklore does encompass something like rites of passage or celebrations, Christmas traditions, the 4th of July, people's birthdays, what happens in a family when everybody has their birthday, and most families will usually do certain special little things. But those are things that people will...